Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
When I hear the word Watchmen, I always think of the comic book series. You know, who's watching the Watchmen, right? I don't know. That's what I always think of. But I learned a couple of weeks ago that there's actually a procedure out there called the Watchmen, and it lowers the risk of stroke from AFib, which is pretty incredible. And my understanding is the 300th Watchman procedure happened just last week at St. Vincent's Medical Center, which is one of the leading centers in the state. And it was done by Dr. Lorenz. Dr. David Lorenz is here. He's an interventional cardiologist and Hartford Healthcare Heart and Vascular Institute at St. V's. Good morning, Dr. Lorenz. Thanks for being here.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
So what is this procedure? What exactly does it entail?
Well, what the Watchman procedure is aimed at is reducing the risk of stroke and at the same time getting what are often elderly patients off of very powerful blood thinners that put them at risk for bleeding or significant trauma when they fall. People have often heard of atrial fibrillation or AFib because it's one of the most common things as a result of aging. It's like an irregular heart rhythm. So the heart doesn't contract quite as well as it normally does.
Okay. So what exactly, is the procedure? Like, what do you do?
Well, we all have kind of this sort of this useless little pouch that hangs off the heart. It's like your appendix. It just causes nothing but misery. And this pouch can fill with clot for people who have atrial fibrillation. And what the normal first step is to thin the blood out with, you've seen advertisements for these blood thinners, Eliquis, Pradaxa, Xarelto, and there's another one called Coumadin, which is older. And these blood thinners really work, but they come with the trade-off that if you slip and fall and crack yourself, you're going to bleed, or you could have a fatal bleed in your head.
Mm.
Or a lot of people have internal bleeding, bad nosebleeds. And they're both expensive and a real nuisance to take. So what the Watchman does, the best way to think about it, it's like putting a wine cork in a wine bottle. I go in there non-surgically through a little IV in the leg while the patient's under sedation for about 45 minutes. And I cross from one side of the heart to the other, and I put this plug in the mouth of the pouch very, very carefully using an X-ray, fancy X-ray machine and an ultrasound down the throat. And that plug is perfectly sized to close the mouth of the pouch off. And then when the pouch is closed, you cannot form a clot there, and therefore you can no longer have a stroke. And so the patient then gets to come off the blood thinner. It does not get rid of the atrial fibrillation. It just treats the biggest concern about AFib, which is the stroke risk.
Wow. I mean, this is amazing. And I'm curious, Dr. Lorenz, if you were to get this procedure done, would you ever have to get on blood thinners to begin with?
Well, there are a couple of different reasons that cardiac patients or even non-cardiac patients need blood thinners. So sometimes people have new or replaced heart valves that are made out of metal. So this has no bearing on that. There are people that have clots in their legs and something called a pulmonary embolism. So there are other reasons that people need to take these powerful blood thinners that are totally separate. But in terms of for atrial fibrillation, it's kind of considered an equivalent to treating it. And these people understand that these poor patients need to be on these blood thinners for life.
Right.
So once
right.
you start a blood thinner for atrial fibrillation, there's no end point. So that's both a cost and a constant concern because, as you know, everyone's living longer. But with that, balance issues really become prevalent in the elderly, and so the bleeding and falling risks don't really go away over time. They, in fact, increase.
We're talking to Dr. Lorenz this morning of St. Vincent's Medical Center. He is an interventional cardiologist, and we're talking about this procedure to lower the risk of stroke from AFib. It's called the Watchman. Now, last week was the 300th procedure of this. So, Dr. Lorenz, am I to believe that this is a relatively new procedure? 300 is a great milestone.
300 both sounds like a lot and doesn't sound like a lot. So let me explain. This was approved in about 2017, but we were very restrictive in terms of who we would put it in as it was a new technology. So So I would say that we were, you know, across the country as a group, the interventional cardiologists who implant these were learning about the safety of the device. And there was a lot of data gathering on both in Europe and in the U.S. population about actually how effective these work. And so there have been a recent series of trials that have strongly suggested and supported how excellent this procedure and implant actually is. And with that, we've really taken off. So our volume, we can't, you know, get enough appointments for people who are asking for this. So we are the lead implant state in the state of implant center in the state of Connecticut.
Wow.
We're very proud of that. And we've, you know, we've had great, great outcomes and very safe procedures for patients.
That was going to be my question, Dr. Lorenz. Has there been any outcomes of the 300 where either the, as you mentioned, kind of like the cork of a bottle, like has it popped out or anything? Has there been any issues or people who've had to come back to get it redone?
Well, that's actually a great question. So what I should say is one of the early concerns was actually, you know, was this low risk concern about the device, you know, coming out. And actually that's never happened for us. And what I would say is even more important is the whole reason that we're doing this procedure is to prevent a stroke. And we are consider it, you know, both validation of the procedure and incredibly important. We've never had a post-Watchman stroke. So that is critical because that's the whole reason you're doing it. So that said, if you look at it, an invasive procedure is an invasive, but it's not surgery. There's no real recovery other than a little bit of soreness and bruising in the leg where the IV, which is about half the size of my pinky, goes into the leg and up to the heart, and we do our work. So any invasive procedure has risks, and we would certainly go into detail with the patients that sit down with us about what those risks are, but it's an incredibly safe procedure.
Chatting this morning with Dr. David Lorenz, who is an interventional cardiologist for Hartford Healthcare Heart and Vascular Institute at St. V's. And actually, St. V's is the leading center in the state for this Watchman procedure. Dr. Lorenz performed the 300th Watchman last week, and it lowers the risk of stroke for AFib. And if you're just tuning in, my question for you, Dr. Lorenz, is who can get this procedure done? I know you kept saying this is more for like elderly, but what age range would you say? Because the reason I ask is I know people on blood thinners for AFib, even in their 40s and 50s. So I'm wondering, like, is that too young? Are you doing patients older? Or like, what's your age range?
Well, it's interesting. There's no exact age cutoff, and maybe I misspoke earlier when I said elderly. We have a very kind of sophisticated scoring system where we add in the patient's risk of stroke for our patients that have AFib. So one of the things that goes into the score is age, but patients who have diabetes, hearts that don't work as well, prior stroke, vascular disease, all of those things go into a calculated score that predicts the risk of having a stroke every year if you're on AFib and if you're not taking a blood thinner. So we can sit down and with our patients and talk about their risk of stroke every year. And if you have a certain risk for stroke, then you are eligible for the Watchman. The Medicare, CMS Medicare, has set guidelines for who's eligible. So we have, you know, sometimes some issues with some private insurance payers covering it, but generally Medicare age is quite simple as long as you hit a certain score. So, but I would say that most who have AFib are eligible right off the bat.
Okay, that was going to be my question then. Okay, I appreciate you clarifying it. And I guess you actually answered my second question, which was, is this something that people should be actively talking to their doctors about? Or if they're already on these blood thinners or already being monitored, this is something doctors will introduce to them, the Watchman?
Well, I would first want to emphasize for the patients that may be listening that are on a blood thinner, the blood thinners really work, okay? They do absolutely work. They just have the trade-off of risks. And there are patients that have tolerated these blood thinners for very long periods of time, and they're totally fine on those. They're totally safe. But there are the risks that arise in certain patients are much higher risk for the side effects relating to taking a blood thinner which are bleeding. And then the balance issues are obviously not related to taking a blood thinner, but if you fall while you're on a blood thinner, then that becomes a much bigger problem. So it's not for everybody, but it's certainly become absolutely a part of the conversation about AFib. And so patients should discuss it with their cardiologist.
Dr. Lorenz, we thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us about this, the Watchman procedure. It's happening at St. Vincent's Medical Center. In fact, Dr. Lorenz performed the 300th last week, and we would love to continue to keep an eye on things like this and other developments. So thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Dr. David Lorenz, again, interventional cardiologist for Hartford Healthcare Heart and Vascular Institute at St. V's, right here on WICC. Excited to have on Susan Patricelli-Regan. And Susan is running for the Republican nomination and hoping to go up against Governor Ned Lamont to become the next governor of Connecticut. Good morning, Susan. Thank you so much for coming on this morning.
Well, I'm delighted to be here with you, and I appreciate you giving me the time to speak to your listeners.
Absolutely. So first of all, Susan, for anyone who's not familiar with you, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, first of all, I think what they need to know is I am a veteran corporate businesswoman. I was with Diageo for 40 years as a marketing and sales executive. Diageo was the former Hubline, which is the largest manufacturer and marketeer of adult beverages in the world. And I traveled the globe for them. I was in U.S. duty-free, U.S. military overseas. I traveled in Europe, Asia, Canada, Mexico, obviously the U.S. as well, Western Hemisphere. So my ability to deal with people of various diversities, I think, is well honed. Obviously, I worked with our finance department, our legal department, and I gained a great deal of experience in, I believe, in good negotiation. As far as extracurricular activities, I have two foundations that I founded. One is it's an equine instructional program for veterans and first responders with PTSD, and we have that on our property in Granby, Connecticut. I'm also working on a bill to have that type of instructional program, which is very helpful to the veterans, with Senator Kissel. So I'm hoping that bill will pass and that that type would be covered under their normal health coverage. Then I also founded a second charity, which is for young people. It's basically of high school age pursuing a career in the creative arts, and that was in memory of my mother, who was an international portrait painter, and her first exhibition was opened in the U.S. She was from Australia, and it was opened in the U.S. and hosted by First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, and it was sponsored by WTIC, the Wadsworth, and G. Fox. And then I have been doing my own TV interview show. It's Connecticut Valley Views, mm-hmm. where I have interviewed probably just about everybody in the state of Connecticut that's worth interviewing, I think, politics, business leaders, medical, education. So I have a very good, I would say, view of people both sides of the aisle. So I think my scope of dealing with people, and I am also the mother of three grown sons, all very successful, well-adjusted in their various careers, and so that's probably my proudest thing to talk about. Mm-hmm. So generally speaking, that's Susan, and then I can talk about what I believe in and what I think is right for Connecticut, but I certainly welcome any questions people have.
Yeah, so Susan, I mean, it's a lot, and I know you have an incredible website that is set mm-hmm. up. If anybody wants to read more on it, susan4ct2022.com. And before I talk about how the state has been run under Governor Lamont, I wanted to talk about getting the Republican nomination because, mm-hmm. We have Bob Stefanowski, who yes. has already gone up against Ned Lamont, lost by a yes. small margin. How do you plan to go up against Bob Stefanowski and take the nomination?
Well, obviously, I think Facebook and the internet and Twitter and so forth is usually utilized for the takedown of people.
Mm.
Quite honestly, I believe now there are some things that I might concern about. First of all, I'd like to say I think Bob Stefanowski is a perfectly good person. I think he has good intentions, as do I, as Themis was possibly going to run for governor, but she's obviously moved on to the Senate race. I think we all have good intentions. What I would like to say is look for the strengths and the skill set that works for the objectives that we need to correct in Connecticut. So if you look at Bob, Bob was a, and this is not to denigrate him, Bob was a Democrat up until 2017, and then he changed parties before he ran in 2018. Additionally, he apparently, I guess his first race in 2018, a lot of people commented wasn't run the right way, should have been easier for him to win because we had 8 years of Malloy and so forth. What I like to talk about is what do I bring to the table, what does Bob bring to the table, or anyone else for that matter, who may decide to run, because there's still time for people to raise their hand. So I think when voters vote, they vote on what this person represents. Do they feel they have integrity? Do they feel they can trust them? Now, Bob has a great deal of money to spend on his campaign. I am a grassroots campaign. But in doing so, I've come outside the Beltway. People say, have you ever run for office before? I say no. But that's a plus for me because I don't have, I'm not, you know, a lot of people are checks in the mail and they send the money and so forth. I'm working on people meeting me in person and believing that when I tell them what I am intending to do, what my objectives are and what my platform is that they believe in me. I want to earn the spot. I don't want to buy the spot.
Yeah, that's and that is a very telling, I think, part of who you are, Susan, which I think is very telling. It's incredible. We are chatting this morning with Susan Patricelli Regan, and she is running for governor. Announced it earlier in the year that she is going to be running for the Republican nomination. And you can actually check out more on Susan if you go to her website, Susan4CT2022.com. And Susan on here, it says truth and transparency equals truth. Trust. Let's talk about your platform a little bit, Susan, and, and really the biggest things you feel like Connecticut is missing right now under the current administration.
Well, I've had right at the top of my list, obviously, we need to talk about our high prices. I mean, inflation is hitting the entire country. However, in the state of Connecticut, we've got gas taxes that I think we need to keep our eye on. TCI may come back on the Democratic agenda. I don't think they'll do it now because Lamont is in full campaign mode. We have we have what I feel to be, and it is moved to the top of my list as I view what's going on in general. I believe in all of the kitchen table things that we need to address: jobs, constitutional protections, school choice. I think we need to watch our immigration reform here. We've got some people who have been placed in the state with us that those are additional costs for us. I am against, I have to tell you, Black Lives Matter violence, and I underline that, and the reason being is that I truly believe that what one of their things on their agenda is to break down the family unit, which is not helping with the juvenile crime. It's not helping with parents in general with their issues. Parents are having problems with the Board of Education because they do not have a right, supposedly, to be involved in what the curriculum will be. I have changed the CRT from critical race theory to critical rational thinking. I think that's where we need to go there. But what's moved to the top of the list for me, a great concern, is the systemic culture of corruption and incompetence in our politics in general. And that is something that I would be looking to change that culture, because I do not believe that we can change any of the other things that I just mentioned unless we have the right people with the right integrity with the in order. When people get into politics, I think most of them want to do something that's a good thing and, mm-hmm. and leave a legacy that they've done a good job. But somehow or other, politics changes people. I think they get carried away. I'm very well aware of that, and I think coming in from the outside, not being part of what I refer to as the old boys club or a career politician, I'm coming in here for the people. I go to the grocery store, Melissa, and I have to tell you what we used to pay for my husband and I, $125 for groceries, it's now close to $200.
Oh, you're right. Mm-hmm.
It's obscene. It's obscene. I take my coupons, just like most families. We return our bottles. I watch our money, and I would watch our budgets the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And I would want to think that the people could, as I said, that the truth and the transparency. And we need to have the people of Connecticut know what the right numbers are. I don't believe we've been given the numbers that they tell us about. I don't think they're correct.
Mm-hmm.
And I would make sure that the Connecticut people know what's going on.
And Susan, you know, if we continue to have a one-party majority in Hartford,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
if that happens in this next election cycle and it is, you know, if you become the next governor, if it mm-hmm. was a Republican mm-hmm. governor, how do you mm-hmm. plan to get a lot done with a Democratic majority?
I think we can put them on a guilt trip because, quite honestly, there are some things. I think there are benefits to people being, you know, in their representative positions. I would want to address that. I think a guilt trip is – when I say guilt trip
– Yeah, what do you mean by that?
I mean, mm-hmm. Yeah, what I mean by that is that when you take an oath to serve your office – you are taking that oath because you will do every day, go to that office, whether it's virtually or in person, and take on what will be the best thing for the people. Now, the people are not stupid, and I think many times they're treated as though, oh, don't worry about it. They won't know what we're talking about, or they won't remember, or whatever. But people, are when I go out in public and I talk to the voters, they are very determined to have someone like me with a voice that is not afraid.
Mm.
I think that's one thing that I can say about me is I am not afraid to address the issues, whether it's equity or CRT or Black Lives Matter or to have a discussion with someone. It would be rather, it would be an entirely different culture that I would set up, a culture that is for the people, we the people. And you can change it. You can. It can be done. It needs negotiation, and I think perhaps bringing people, you know, to the table and making them realize that they have been lying. I don't like the lying and what's going on. It's as I said.
Yeah, and I don't think you're alone on that, Susan. I think there have been a lot of questions. You know, even just looking at how long, you know, there have been questions about why we keep extending, well, we aren't anymore, but extending, you know, the governor's executive orders so long,
yes.
you know, and why do we elect people if they're not going to speak on our behalf for so long? I think you're asking questions that, like you said, a lot of people have been asking on both sides of the aisle, So,
we're not just limiting it to the Democrats, but I think I didn't quite address your question when you said if you have a majority of Democrats in the legislature, what I'm hoping is that we have very good, on the Republican side, that we have very good candidates for various seats. I'm looking to see who might be lieutenant governor, who might run. But I think Secretary of State, I think that's a very important one. I think that, you know, we have to have candidates that are on the same page that I am. If we are not standing together, and I do find that one of the faults of the Republicans, the Democrats do stand in a straight phalanx, and Republicans tend to be a bit fractured. And quite honestly, I think there's fear of Republicans when it comes to stating things or agreeing or disagreeing with things. There's a certain fear that they may lose their spot, their political spot or career, if they say anything against what's going on. In other words, it's easier to go along to get along. And I want to see more bravery. I want to be that leader that instills confidence to be brave. That's what we need.
Well, Susan Patricelli, Regan, we so appreciate you giving us the time this morning. And again, if you want to check out her website, susan4ct2022.com. Susan, thank you so much for taking the time and coming on this morning. I really appreciate it.
And I appreciate your time, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Welcoming back to the show this morning, Stephanie Swantek of the Be Safe Project out of Bridges Healthcare in Milford. Good morning, Steph. Thanks for being here. How are you?
Hi, good morning. I'm well. Thank you.
So I'm so excited that we kind of share one brain. I love that. You know, Steph will send me things that she's talking to high schoolers about, their parents about, because for anyone who doesn't realize, Steph, you know, goes into a lot of different high schools, and some of the work that she does is just is phenomenal. And she helps us here on the show to better talk to our kids, handle some of these weird, I'm going to call them bizarre kind of conversations, or they feel like they're bizarre, but they're not. And today we're talking about encouraging parents to advocate for their children. What do you mean by that? What exactly do you want to discuss?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, again, the topics that my program works in is all around like mental health and sexual and reproductive health. And so with those topics, so many students disclose things that have happened to them or currently happening to them or things they've seen at school or et cetera. And a lot of the times, you know, obviously as a mandated reporter, teachers, staff are mandated reporters. But with that said, while we have to then, you know, bring that, escalate the situation to, you know, a student resource officer, whatever the protocol is in that school, the social worker, we need to, a DCF call, we need to report that. But a lot of the times when we just quote unquote follow that protocol, the child, the student, they get lost in the process and their voice gets lost and their experience gets lost. And we just think about justice and not advocating and supporting that student in what they have experienced. And so a lot of the times too, we rely on a student, school resource officer or the principal or the social worker to make the time, make the appropriate call. But as a parent or a guardian, we also need to be aware of who might my child is talking to, who can they rely on, who are they assigned to in the schools, so that when they do have something and who, you know, going on, that they know who they can rely on, who they can trust. And there's also a relationship between the parent, the guardian, and some of that school staff.
And this is why I was saying that we share one brain, because one of our news stories this morning is that Senator Blumenthal, for example, came out with a new bill. It's a bipartisan bill, and I don't dislike it. I think it's fine, but what it speaks to, I'd say, is a bigger picture, the Kids Online Safety Act, which is basically providing parents with tools to protect their children from harmful content online. And the thing I was discussing on the show was, sure, you know, that's fine, more tools for parents to use. But I think the bigger thing here is you can only put those protections in place for so long. And kind of what you were saying, Steph, you know, we can only rely on resource officers, principals, and school staff for so long. But at the end of the day, they're your kids. And your kids need to be able to approach you and tell you things, even if they're uncomfortable. But part of advocating for your children is also not judging them. You know, I think it's very hard when you see some of the things that go on in society, or it's different from how your generation was, and immediately you want to go, well, why are you thinking like that? Or why are they talking about that? Or why do you hang out with kids like that? And that turns your children off from ever wanting to come to you about things. And
right.
That's where I felt like, you know, what I was talking about with social media connects very much to what you're talking about, which is that we can't just rely on protections on social media or just on school resource officers, because they're our kids. We got to be able to advocate for them and talk to them.
Yeah, we need to be active, right? We need to be active, like in their lives, knowing who they're, you know, who they're in contact with, what they're exposed to, but also to, like, culturally, right? Like, I'm in 5 high schools, for example. Each school has a different culture, and so your child is operating amongst that culture, and so then you have, like, that culture, right? The expectations, how they're treated, mm-hmm. you know, what the expectations are and how they are treated, they treat their teachers, et cetera. But in addition to, then you have, again, what you mentioned, online culture. And I can't even mention, too, a little bit of a red flag of how many of these pages, there's these, like, hidden pages of, like, racist pages and sexual assault pages and so many different types of these pages that are hidden that your child has access to within the school, not within the school, but kids are involved in. And so it's like these, like, kind of dark pages online that then get escalated to maybe the principal, to an SRO. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they get, again, they get taken care of, and sometimes they don't. And so
right.
You as a parent need to be active in what they have access to, what they're involved in, and all those pieces.
Exactly. And Stephanie Swantek is here of the Be Safe Project out of Bridges Healthcare in Milford. And we're talking about advocating for our children and even just encouraging our kids to go to safe places outside of school. And I want to make this very clear, because Stephanie is somebody who works in a lot of the schools, resource offices, our staff, our faculty members, the people who advocate for the kids in school. I'm not knocking them whatsoever. The work that they do is amazing, but they've got to work with hundreds of children, hundreds of kids. And at the end of the day, I do think sometimes as parents, we lean on other people to control some of the things that our kids do. When in actuality, I think it is worth a conversation with your kids to be open. And even if you don't agree with some of the things that are being discussed, you know, you don't want your child to feel shame or to feel like they should not be questioning things. Because I don't know if you agree with this, Stephanie, but I think the more that we place judgment on the things that they're questioning or they're looking at or they have questions about, the more that they pull away from us and they feel like we're not going to amount to what you want us to be because we don't agree about something, or I have questions about something, or I'm curious and you clearly don't like it. So I'm going to go elsewhere, or I'm going to be sneaky about it. I don't know if you're in your professional opinion, you agree with that.
Yes. Right. So if I don't get the support right from whatever family looks like or home looks like, then I will 100% find it elsewhere. And so, again, the question is, if I'm not receiving that support, I get it elsewhere. What does that look like? And again, what does that communication look like between home and child? And then when there is a red flag or there's an issue that comes up at school, sometimes a parent just says, you know, to a staff person, fix it. No, you also were operating in that. You also contributed to this problem, this struggle, because it could have been maybe prevented. You know, we could have gotten a hold of it sooner. There's so many pieces. Like, you need to be an active member in your child's life, along with school staff and teachers, and an open communication with your child, et cetera. Be an active member.
Stephanie Swantek is here of the Be Safe Project out of Bridges Healthcare. We're talking about better advocating for our kids and just bridging that conversation when they see things online or when things happen in school. Even if it's really serious, you don't want to believe that that happens to your children or that they witness things happening. How do you better communicate with them? How do you get them to share these things with you so you can advocate for them better? So that is my question, Steph. I think that's my final question is, if you are sort of set in the ways of your life, the way that you've been doing things, and you find that your children are not coming to you about these kinds of things, and you find out from the school, or you find out later on that they were looking for it online, what can you do to better that situation? How do you get your kids to start talking to you?
So, you know, again, there's so many programs out there that exist that work with youth, work through school systems or outside the school system, whatever your child or student is most comfortable with. So some kids are like, I just want to get out of school as soon as it's over. But even in regards to, like, my program, right, the Be Safe Project, we work around sexual and reproductive health, or anything sexual, in addition to mental health. And so, again, we work with students all around these different topics, and communication and their bodies changing and curiosity, or things that happen to them. And so with the consent of the child, a lot of times we're able to kind of connect with the student. Connect with the parent. So we start those communications. And sometimes it's as simple as, you know, getting the consent from the child that they just miss their parents. They miss, you know, their child, their parents making time for them, and they're too busy. And sometimes it's as simple as that. And so making the time, and sometimes even that bridges those gaps. But again, there's always someone that a parent can trust to have these conversations and create that those supports that maybe the parent does not feel comfortable doing. So in school, out of school, there's lots of programs such as mine, and we always make referrals out from my program for additional services if it's something else that we can't handle as well. So they exist.
Stephanie, if somebody wants to reach out to you, they want your help in having these conversations or figuring out how to better their relationship with their kids, is there a way they can reach you?
Of course, yeah. So swantek at milfordbridges.org, or my direct line, 475-202-2827.
Stephanie Swantek, always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.